welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 26th of October 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Yes, it's the beginning of the week again, and we've got some really interesting British news to get into today, and who better to get into the news with than Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, hello sir, how are you doing today?
Good afternoon. I'm very well indeed, and I think that we are living in increasingly interesting times, as the Chinese would say. That somebody reminded me of a quotation that somebody made quite recently, which is that, you know, people very often despair at the declining standards and the decline of Western civilization, and almost as if it's deploring the whole thing as the end of the world. And of course it is a deplorable thing, and but it won't bring about the end of the world, but the quotation, or the aspect of the quotation which I found particularly poignant, was that we could have just been born during any time of plenty and of ease, where our lives would have meant nothing, and we would have lived our lives and died, and we'd never have had a chance of achieving great things. Whereas we've actually been blessed with the opportunity of, or with the fact that we're living through a turbulent political period, and a period that will be pivotal as far as the future of the world is concerned. And we've got the opportunity to play a part in the changes that will inevitably come, and we have the chance of playing our part in a heroic struggle, and perhaps of demonstrating our worth in through our own personal heroism in promoting the interests and the future survival of our people.
I think we're living in great times, and that is the way to look at it. If we weren't living in this time like this, we wouldn't be reminded of who we are. We wouldn't be reminded of what it is we should be doing, the things that we are capable of. We would just be taking things for granted. It's only through the struggle that we really do achieve greatness. Without that struggle, we would be nothing. We'd have nothing to rise above. And that's what it's all about, being white, is rising above and reaching up and always reaching for more, and always yearning for more, and achieving greatness. Our people have achieved great things in the past, which is why we have our Greatest Britain series, of course. But I think we ought to start with a revisit to a subject that we talked about quite a lot over the last couple of years that we haven't mentioned for, well, quite some time now, and that was the Labour anti-Semitism accusations that were all around Jeremy Corbyn. We did lots of work on this, and about how this was waking up white people, particularly people in Labour, as to the disproportionate amount of power that Jews had. And since Jeremy Corbyn is no longer the leader of the Labour Party, it all seems to have gone quiet. But I believe you picked up on a rather unexpected bit of news in that quarter this week, Max. Do you want to begin with that?
Yeah, it's just that, as you've been saying, people have tended to assume that with the replacement of Jeremy Corbyn as the Labour leader and the appearance on the scene of Keir Starmer in his place, that the issue of anti-Semitism on the left is a dead issue. And of course, from our perspective, it was fairly clear that the accusations of anti-Semitism that were levelled at Jeremy Corbyn were pretty much baseless accusations that were intended to simply drive Jeremy Corbyn from office as Labour leader, so that the anti-Zionism that he professes couldn't be used at a future date should he become the Prime Minister of Britain to damage the interests of Israel. And it's very clear, really, that it's Zionists that have used the excuse of anti-Semitism as a means of attacking that ex-Labour leader. And the interesting aspect of it was that I noticed that there was an article on the Jewish Chronicle website which dealt with the fact that a sort of well-known academic, Norman Finkelstein, had been speaking at, and I think it was done over Zoom or something of that sort, but speaking at a meeting that's been organised by a number of people that are fairly prominent on the what perhaps might be described as the extreme left, Professor David Miller, Jackie Walker, Mark Wadsworth, and Chris Williamson, who had held a meeting of what they are describing as Labour Against the Witch Hunt, which is an organisation composed of current Labour members and ex-Labour members who believe that the accusations of anti-Semitism that were levelled at the Labour Party and that were levelled at them specifically were just smear campaigns and were a witch hunt in order to remove them from any positions of influence and to remove Jeremy Corbyn from his position of influence within the Labour Party. And it's just interesting that Norman Finkelstein, who is somebody who is normally thought of as being a source that people on the far right, in inverted commas, would call upon in order to question the validity of the Holocaust, or in order to question the way in which the Holocaust is used as a political weapon. And I sort of briefly mentioned what I regard as a sort of a paranoia on the part of not all Jews, but on the part of a number of influential Jews and quite a large number of Jewish organizations. And it just amused me that the paranoia that they have, the fact that they have tended to attack Norman Finkelstein because of his views that he has proffered quite sort of widely and fairly courageously, I would say. And because of the attacks that they've made on various members of the Labour Party, including Jeremy Corbyn, that something that they have that they may sort of come to regret, I suppose, in the future is that they are pushing both the far right in terms of the attacks that they make upon us, where we criticise the use of the Holocaust as a political weapon. Together, they're pushing us towards the extreme left. And it was interesting that this Labour Against the Witch Hunt meeting had taken place. And it then also came to my attention that Norman Finkelstein had attended a communist university, it's called, communist university meeting that was organised by the Communist Party of Great Britain. And in, I think it was 2016, he spoke at some length about the way in which the Holocaust is regarded within politics, within the political sphere generally, but also particularly in the way in which it was regarded amongst Jews. And of course, Norman Finkelstein grew up in post-war United States, and as he says, until 1967, when the Six-Day War took place, the Holocaust was a non-story as far as Jews in America were concerned. It was something that they never really spoke about, never really wrote about, and it was an issue that tended only to be spoken about amongst people who were regarded as communists and people who perhaps would therefore be regarded as being suspect because of sympathies with the Soviet Union. And so amongst polite society within the Jewish community, people tended not to refer to the Holocaust for fear of being accused of being a communist and of having disloyalty to the United States. And he then mentions about how when the Six-Day War took place, the Israelis portrayed the Six-Day War as being them reacting to a sort of mounting threat from Arab nationalists. But according to Norman Finkelstein, the Six-Day War was a preemptive strike. It was basically an attack by Israel against the Arab states, which was totally unexpected, and which then enabled the Israeli Air Force to destroy the Egyptian Air Force on the ground and therefore defeat the Arabs, because the Arabs then had no air cover and were bound to lose the Six-Day War. But that as a result of the Six-Day War, the Israel became associated with the United States as an ally of the United States and vice versa. And so therefore it became became acceptable for people to be Jewish and to talk about Jewish issues far more openly. And because the United Nations were pressuring the Israelis to return the lands that they had captured from the Arabs as part of a peace settlement. And the fact that the Israelis didn't want to do that, that the Israelis and that the Zionists then decided to use the Holocaust narrative as a political weapon in order to dissuade people from advocating in favour of the Arabs and against the Israelis, and that this is the root of the what Norman Finkelstein calls the Holocaust industry that he's written a book about. And but I, you know, amongst all of this, I think I've sort of drifted away from my sort of original point that I was making. But amongst all of this is the fact that it's quite amusing that what we find is that a man who's written a book on a theme which is often associated with the far right is actually presenting the same information to the extreme left wing of the Labour Party, and also presenting that same information at these communist universities. And so it would appear that an unforeseen eventuality of using the Holocaust as a weapon against both the right and also the left is that it kind of has driven, it seems to be driving us together in a single mind in terms of our interpretation of the way in which the Holocaust is regarded in popular circles. And it's ironic, really, that that's the way things have turned out. And I'm sure that people will use this to try and claim that there's no difference between the extreme right and the extreme left, etc. But what it actually shows is that if you use something as a weapon on the basis that your enemy's enemy becomes your friend, it does tend to, if you use a weapon too widely, drive people together instead of driving them apart.
I find that really interesting, you know, because they've used that against us for so long, haven't they? Nationalism will lead to another Holocaust, and remember the 6 million before you start criticizing Jews. And they turned that on the Labour Party. They turned it on Britain's left wing. So, of course, Britain's left wing are then going to think, well, hang on a minute, we don't want to Holocaust any Jews. We just want to criticize Israel. But because that weapon has been used against them, then they're going to become interested in this. They're going to become aware of the fact that the Holocaust is used in that way to shut down debate. And that has now resulted in Norman Finkelstein speaking to this group of Labour MPs or backbenchers or whatever they are. I mean, I find that absolutely fascinating. And also the bit there that you pointed out, that how originally it was talked about by communist Jews and not really talked about in polite society. And of course, that ties into the fact that it was only in the camps that the USSR liberated that they claimed that any gassings took place. They didn't actually claim any took place in the German occupied camps. It was just the ones that the Allied occupied camps, rather. It was just the ones on the other side of the Iron Curtain. And of course, nobody could actually go and investigate to see whether that was true. We just had to take the communists' word for it. And of course, we know that the communists lied about lots of things. So the fact that it was only the communists that were talking about it then tends to imply that people understood that as well, that was not going to be, it was not going to be the truth because it was coming from these communists. And after that 6 day war, Hollywood then started making Holocaust movies, and they also slipped pornography in with the first Holocaust movie. And that sort of paved the way for pornographic scenes in movies ever since. But that was when they really started up with the Holocaust industry, with the movies that they started making, exaggerating things that went on there, and really got that into the public's mind so that then they could use it to silence criticism. And I should imagine that people on the left are now starting to discover all of this, and it's all been a result of these Jewish advocacy groups overplaying their hand in trying to get rid of the Labour Party leader. And of course, at the same time, that also showed the members of the Labour Party that Jewish groups do have a disproportionate amount of power in society. They have the power to take over all the headlines of every single newspaper and direct them against whoever it is that they want to direct their ire against. And this is another side effect, a bit of blowback from their campaign against Jeremy Corbyn. And I am surprised that they actually had Norman Finkelstein there. I keep getting tongue-tied actually trying to pronounce his name. But it's great that he had the courage to expose all of this and expose the Holocaust industry. And he was also very critical of the amount of money that was being made out of it, because of course there's been millions, billions of dollars that have been paid out. Germany is paying out billions of dollars to COVID, people with COVID now in Israel. Holocaust survivors that might catch COVID are getting extra payments. It's incredible, this industry that has started up from the Holocaust. So yeah, that's fantastic that the Labour Party are being spoken to by him. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
Well, just that, as far as Norman Finkelstein is concerned, he isn't a Holocaust denier in the sense that he denies the Holocaust took place, because there's quite a long, it's about a 2-hour long video, which I watched earlier on today, actually, which is on the internet. So if you just Google Norman Finkelstein Communist University 2016, the video will come up, and it's well worth watching, actually, from the point of view of the background information that it gives with regard to the Jewish sense of identity, how the Jewish community in the United States of America view themselves, what their aims and ambitions are, that kind of thing. It contains lots of very interesting anecdotes and bits of information that some of which I found quite amusing. Norman Finkelstein comes over as a person who's a little bit nerdy, I think, and he describes himself as being a bit nerdy. As I say, that there were a number of statements that he made which were just laugh out loud funny as a result of, which is kind of ironic in that he didn't necessarily mean them to be funny, but they just came out funny that way, just because of his manner in the way that he delivered it. But it's well worth watching if you've got a spare couple of hours, and gives you lots of background information with regard to Jewish thinking during the early post-war period and also during the period of the Six-Day War.
Were you saying also that he wants to see Holocaust denial taught in schools, with Holocaust deniers brought into the schools so that people can then try and debate the Holocaust denier? Is that one of his ideas?
Yeah, I think this is something that he's put forward, which I think, you know, he feels that if the story is essentially true, and he believes the Holocaust narrative to be essentially true, then that it is strengthened by being questioned. And that as far as any subject is concerned, if you make it sacrosanct in law that nobody can question a narrative, then of course that narrative, anybody recounting that narrative is then going to be tempted, if they feel they might benefit by doing so, to exaggerate the narrative, knowing that nobody can actually counteract or oppose what they've said, the narrative will then become so distorted that it becomes just simply unbelievable, and it will because of that freedom kill itself. Whereas if you have a narrative that you believe to be essentially true and you expose it to criticism, then that criticism will expose any inconsistencies and enable those inconsistencies to be overcome and to be explained, so that the story remains relevant and remains believable. And that's, I think, in a nutshell, what Norman Finkelstein's position was with regard to the teaching of Holocaust denial. But obviously, I think, you know, we might take a slightly different view of that in view of the outrageous exaggerations that appear to have been made in certain places within the Holocaust narrative.
Well, this is just it, isn't it? Nothing should be afraid of criticism. Everything should be held up and examined under a microscope, and that's how you get to the truth of things. If you're going to say something can't be criticised, it can't be investigated, you can't ask questions about it, then obviously that's leading it open to accusations of, well, it can't be true then. Especially when you get ludicrous numbers like six million Jews that were gassed, and talking of the actual gassing themselves, and that just being caused by throwing cyanide pellets through holes in the roof and wooden doors that opened inwards, and not enough cremation ovens, and all sorts of stuff that just doesn't add up with the story. And of course, if they believe the story is true, then why can they not come out with answers to this? Why can it not be criticized? So yeah, that's great to see that he's not afraid to criticize it, and it's great to see that the Labour Party are taking an interest in that. The next news story that I've got here is really the reversal of the news story that we talked about last week with the stickers, the 100-hander stickers that have been put up in the Jewish area in London. And that was a negative sticker campaign. It was intimidating for the Jews to see stickers there that were anti-Jewish stickers, essentially. And I pointed out that's negative propaganda, and that's not what we want. Well, there's been a very, very good bit of propaganda by somebody putting up these 100-handers stickers over the weekend. And the actual headline from the Daily Record says, "Vile neo-Nazi group spreads sick campaign of hate to Scotland's highest peak." And they've got five ad hominems there just within one sentence. I mean, you would think that this was an absolutely horrific thing that they had done to Scotland's highest peak. Maybe they've blown it up or something like that, or maybe they've graffitied all over it or left a load of rubbish or something. But what they tell us is that a mob of Nazi hate mongerers, they put here, I guess that must be a typo, have spread their sick propaganda to the top of Britain's highest peak. The Record exposed the activities of the 100-handers network, who spread their race hate message across Scotland through public stickers and social media. Now we can reveal that their activists have placed one of their twisted propaganda messages on the top of Ben Nevis. The 100-handers sticker, exhorting white people to love your nation, was stuck up inside a hut on the 4,411-foot peak. Well, how about that? Just saying love your nation is now a sick campaign of hate. That is described as sick propaganda. That is described as a race hate message. And of course, anybody reading this is just going to think, these guys that run the newspapers, they're absolutely insane. What is wrong with saying love your nation? I mean, that is the modern day equivalent of love your neighbor. And they're saying this is a sick campaign of hate. Everybody should love their nation. They should do what is best for the nation. And this really does make it clear that the people that run our media hate our nation. I mean, that's got to be what they mean, isn't it? If they say that it's a sick campaign of hate to say love your nation, when it is the indigenous British people that are saying that, they are saying that we should be saying hate your nation. You should hate your nation. That's the message that this piece of mainstream media is telling us. This is what I mean by positive propaganda. If we put out positive propaganda, then the mainstream media then put out negative pieces to accompany it. And when people see that, it really opens their eyes as to how much we are hated as the indigenous British people, how much we are hated by our own media. I mean, I thought this was an absolutely fantastic bit of activism here, and I'd like to see more stickers like that, more positive stickers mentioning love rather than intimidatory things. And also, I mean, that's pretty audacious to put it right up there on the top of the Ben Nevis peak, and it got into the mainstream media. It's been shared all across the internet. Just a wonderful piece of activism here that contrasts with the activism that we highlighted last week. Do you want to comment on this at all, Max, this sticker campaign here?
Just to agree with what you said, that's the unintended consequence of this over-the-top reaction, and so what you could accurately describe as a rabid reaction on the part of the newspaper concerned here, will mean that people will stop believing what that newspaper writes on other issues. If you If you take something which obviously is a simple statement of love, and you try to portray that simple statement of love as being a twisted hate, then people are going to question your sanity. And I would think that people reading that story would question the sanity of the person that wrote it. And again, it's another example of an idea being regarded as sacrosanct. And as far as the media are concerned, they've got it into their heads now that anything associated with nationalism, anything which opposes multiculturalism, is to be deplored. And because they know that the entire commercial media is currently in the hands of our political enemies, and therefore that we have got no means of redress against any accusations that they make, it induces them to make the wildest kind of accusations and to grossly exaggerate to a degree that they probably would have regarded as insane in any other time, in any other place, and in doing so they are overstepping the bounds and just making themselves appear ridiculous and having the opposite effect of what they would hope to have, in exactly the same way that this last story we've just been talking about, where the Holocaust narrative is regarded as sacrosanct and that nobody is allowed to question the Holocaust narrative, and that causes people who write stories and write books about the Holocaust to exaggerate the things that took place during the Second World War in German concentration camps, and that by through that exaggeration, as Norman Finkelstein has correctly deduced, through that exaggeration, they undermine the believability of their own story. And so hopefully the reaction of this newspaper will undermine the believability of everything else they print as well. And people will come to examine these questions from a rational perspective and draw the right healthy conclusions.
Well, the more we can get them to admit that they hate us and expose themselves in such a way, the better it is. Just a fantastic bit of activism there. Well done to whoever it was climbed up to the top of Ben Nevis and put that pledge of love to the nation up there. Well, that's pretty much it for the news this week. We've got some more on our Greatest Britons to get into. Major General Charles George Gordon, that we began last week, and we'll start with a little recap of where we got to. We talked about his early life, how he was the son of a general. He was the fifth generation of military men, so it ran in his family, being in the military. We talked about how he fought in the trenches of the Crimea, and he was noted for his bravery there. And then he went to China, where he led the Ever Victorious Army, which was a group of mercenaries, pretty much. And he was absolutely appalled by the Chinese atrocities that he saw there on both sides, on the Taiping Rebellion and also from the Imperial Army. And General Gordon actually had people shot for looting, and the Chinese didn't want to actually pay the troops. They just wanted to let them loot and pillage and rampage. And Gordon was really disgusted at this. And he wanted to take prisoners of war, and he wanted to treat the prisoners of war well. And he gave his oath that if any of the Taiping gave themselves up, they would not be massacred. And instead, when the Taiping gave themselves up, they were all massacred, along with all their families, their wives, their children. And Gordon was absolutely furious at this. And the emperor tried to give him a reward, and he snubbed the emperor, and his military career in China was then effectively over for a time. And during his time with the Ever Victorious Army, Gordon had won 33 battles in succession, but had written a letter home that his losses were no joke, as 48 of his 100 officers and about 1,000 of 3,500 soldiers had been killed or wounded in action, which he took as being a very bad thing. Do you want to add anything to that recap? You got any comments you want to make on that, Max?
Only that you know, what we discussed last week about Gordon sets him out as being somebody who is an archetypal European leader, and somebody who is of a charismatic disposition, and somebody who is honourable to a fault.
Oh, he's definitely the British archetype of keeping your word and doing things properly and putting other people first. And he really took that seriously, as we will see. Well, the Emperor did eventually promote Gordon, and he promoted him to the rank of Chief Commander of Jiangsu Province, which was a title equal to Field Marshal. He decorated him with the Imperial Yellow Jacket and raised him to King's Viscount First Class, but Gordon declined an additional gift of 10,000 pieces of silver from the Imperial Treasury. Only 40 men were allowed to wear the Yellow Jacket, which was the Emperor's ceremonial bodyguard, and it was thus a signal honour for Gordon to be allowed to wear it. The British Army promoted Gordon to Lieutenant Colonel on the 16th of February 1864, and he was appointed a Companion of the Order of the Bath on the 9th of December 1864, and that's to do with being knighted, I think, the Order of the Bath. The traders of Shanghai offered Gordon huge sums of money to thank him for his work commanding the ever-victorious army, but Gordon declined all honours of financial gain, writing, "I know I shall leave China as poor as I entered it, but with the knowledge that through my weak instrumentality upwards of 80 to 100,000 lives have been spared, I want no further satisfaction than this." The British journalist Mark Urban wrote, "People saw a brave man who acted with humanity in an otherwise ghastly conflict, standing out from the other mercenaries, adventurers and cutthroats in wanting almost nothing for himself." In a leader in August 1864, the Times wrote about Gordon, "The part of the soldier of fortune is in these days very difficult to play with honour, but if ever the actions of a soldier fighting in foreign service ought to be viewed with indulgence and even with admiration, this exceptional tribute is due to Colonel Gordon." The savage Taiping Rebellion, which was the bloodiest war of the entire 19th century, taking somewhere between 20 and 30 million lives, is largely forgotten in the West today. But at the time, the civil war in China attracted much media attention in the West, and Gordon's command of the ever-victorious army received much coverage from British newspapers, and this is where Gordon gained his popular nickname of Chinese Gordon. So we see there that he's refusing to take the coin from the traders as well. And don't forget, this was the Opium War as well. So Gordon is in this to try and do his best for his country. He's in it to try and save as many lives as possible. He is not in this for the money. And I think we can detect here that he's not too impressed with the traders and the merchants, because he didn't want to take their money. He could have taken their money, and he could have given it to charity, but he just didn't want to take it at all. And in the same way, he refused to take the coin from the emperor as well, because the emperor had broken his oath. And we can see here that he's becoming extremely popular with the British, and he's being lionized in the newspapers for this attitude that he has. And the fact that he is lionized for this, and he was huge in the newspapers, says that this is the sort of mentality that the British people had, and they wanted to see people like that. They wanted to see people being really good. They weren't interested in gossip and adultery and sleaze. They were interested in learning about really virtuous British men that set a really good example within the British Empire and within the other countries that Britain was trading with. So it tells us something about the British public back at home, as well as about this very virtuous man. Do you want to add any comments there, Max?
Well, just that the Opium Wars are very often portrayed as being an ignoble period of British history, where we apparently, and I don't know the full ins and outs of the Opium Wars, but where certain British interests represented in China were involved in the opium trade, and I don't doubt that that may be the case. But what Gordon's life and Gordon's time in China teaches us is that wasn't the that wasn't what the British public were expecting of our troops in and our representatives in China. And as far as Gordon is concerned, you know, he was somebody who stood apart from any corruption of that sort, and was somebody who was motivated by the highest human ideals.
And we have to be careful not to project our own ideals from today 150 years ago as to what was happening at this time. I mean, we would look at opium today, we would look at it as an addictive drug, it's a terrible thing. It's probably only as addictive as tobacco. And tobacco sales were also a part of the British Empire. That went on for much longer. And what had happened was the Chinese had agreed to take this opium. That was part of their contract, is they would take a certain amount of opium every year. It would be made in Afghanistan and India. It would then be transported to China, and the Chinese, in exchange for that, they would give the British tea or whatever else it was. And it was just purely seen as trade. And what happened was the Chinese ended up having a serious problem with this opium, and masses of them started getting addicted to it. And you've got to remember, opium was legal everywhere, and it was only in China that they discovered they had this huge problem with it. It was legal back in Britain, and we didn't have this problem with, you know, half the country being addicted to it. That was something that was specific to China, but they had made this contract that they were going to take all this opium, and the British had made all this opium. Okay, it was Sassoon, it was Jewish merchants that were responsible for it. It was their trade, but they were seen as a part of the British Empire, and so our British Army had to go over there, and this Taiping Rebellion formed a part of it. And this was actually the Second Opium War. So not a good thing to go to war about. But we have to be very careful about projecting today's sensibilities onto what was going on back then, because we can see what Gordon was like, and I would say he was probably far more virtuous than most people that are around today. We'll see more of that, in fact, in this next piece. After he arrived in Britain, Gordon announced to the press that he did not want to board the tram of the world, and he asked to be left alone. Following the death of his father, he undertook extensive social work in the town, including teaching at the local ragged school. Before 1870, there was no universal school system in Britain, and the ragged schools were a network of privately funded schools that gave a free education to children whose parents were too poor to afford the school fees. During his time at Gravesend, Gordon was much involved in charity work, trying to ensure that homeless boys he found begging on the street did not go hungry, while attempting to find them homes and jobs. Many of the scuttlers, as Gordon fondly called the homeless boys, were taken in by him to live at his home, the Fort House. Outside of the Fort House, there was graffiti written on the wall by one of the evidently less educated boys that read, "God bless the Colonel," spelt with a K. Another scuttler later recalled, "He made me feel, first of all, the meaning of the phrase, the goodness of God. Goodness become to me, through Gordon, the most desirable of ideas. We were under the spell of Gordon's personality. We lived in the magic of his mystery, enchanted." And every year, Gordon actually gave away 90% of his annual income of £3,000, which is equivalent to £333,000 last year, to charity. Chinese Gordon did not enjoy his celebrity status, and though Gordon was extremely charismatic, he only kept a limited circle of friends and found dealing with strangers difficult. A colleague recalled that Gordon's time at Gravesend was the most peaceful and happy of his life, but Gordon was often bored and constantly asking the War Office for an assignment to somewhere dangerous, often speaking nostalgically of his service in China and how he wished he could return to that country. So we can see here that he just wants to help people, really, and he goes to the poorest group in society, the poor boys, and tries to give them an education, helps out at the school, tries to help these kids out, these orphaned kids, finding them work or finding them homes that they can stay in. And we can see that they were very pleased to actually get his help. And, I mean, that's a massive amount of his income that he was giving away, 90%.
And unlike modern celebrities, he's welcomed a large number of poor and destitute boys into his home and given them the support that they needed in order to get an education. So it, again, marks him out as an exceptional person.
Yeah, not just an incredible fighter and courageous on the battlefield, but also virtuous to his own people. I think this was to his own people as well that he was doing this. He was giving this money away, and he was helping those that weren't so well off. And one thing that I was thinking the other day, actually, about this, and with the British Empire, one of the things that we've discussed is the way that when we had the British Empire, you could start from absolutely nothing and you could work your way up to being the general of a province. And we've talked about quite a few of these people that started off with absolutely nothing, and then they bought their promotions, and they ended up running parts of India or being the governor general of the whole of India. And all of this was through merit, because the British Empire was built on merit. They didn't have diversity quotas for the poor. They didn't have affirmative action for the poor. They didn't have laws to prevent people from criticizing the poor. Everything was done on merit, and the British Empire was really proud of that fact, that we had this system where people could basically go up the classes. They could work their way up the classes. If they showed they had merit and they showed they had those skills, they could do that. And then because we now have multiculturalism, we've imported all these other peoples from the world, and they don't seem to be able to do that. They did not seem to be able to function within our system of merit. So now we've had to bring in all these other things that we have, all the diversity quotas and the rest of it. And that, to me, it says that these diversity quotas are wrong. We had the perfect system with the British Empire. People could work their way up through the classes. And the fact that the non-whites that we have here now couldn't shows me that they are completely different to us, because we had a meritorious system. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
No, I think you've said what you said there is just about says it all.
Well, let's get into his marriage now and some modern slurs, because Gordon never actually married and is not known to have had a sexual or romantic relationship with anyone, claiming that his army service and frequent travels to dangerous places made it impossible for him to marry, as he was a dead man walking who could only hurt a potential wife, as it was inevitable that he would die in battle. And I believe Cecil Rhodes said similar as well, and when we discussed him.
Yes.
The British historian Dennis Judd writes, like two other great imperial heroes of his time, Kitchener and Cecil Rhodes, Gordon was a celibate. The repression of Gordon's sexual instincts helped to release a flood of celibate energy, which drove him into weird beliefs, eccentric activities, and a sometimes misplaced confidence in his own judgment. And those are all negative things. I would also like to say that, you know, it probably made him very creative as well. It encouraged his virtuousness. It encouraged his courage and his energy at wanting to go out and do all these things. The sublimation of the sexual instinct, it's a creative instinct. It creates life. So it's also going to help a person to be creative if they sublimate that sexual instinct, I would have thought. Gordon's charitable work for the Boys of Gray's End has led to later accusations in the 20th century that he was a homosexual. But no one at the time suspected Gordon of having sexual relations with the legions of teenage boys living with him at the Fort House. And the claim was first made by Lytton Strachey in his book Eminent Victorians, which his biographer Fout commented says more about Strachey than it actually does about Gordon. Fout maintains that Gordon was a heterosexual whose Christian beliefs led him to maintain his virginity right up to his death, as he believed that sexual intercourse was incompatible with his faith. About the frequent references in Gordon's letters about his need to resist temptation and subdue the flesh, Fout argues that it was women rather than men who were tempting him. The South African minister, Dr. Peter Hammond, also denies that Gordon was a homosexual, citing the numerous statements made by Gordon condemning homosexuality as an abomination, charging that the claim that Gordon was gay was a theory with no foundations in fact. The British historian Paul Mersch suggested that Gordon was not gay, but rather his awkwardness with women was due to Asperger's syndrome, which made it extremely difficult for him to express his feelings for women properly. And I think it's really sad that, you know, they accuse this guy of being homosexual today when he was just extremely charitable to young boys, tried to help young boys. I mean, what does that say? It means that nobody's going to want to help young boys because they might get accused of being homosexual. I mean, at this time, yeah, when it was illegal, you could help young boys. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with doing that. And we should want to help our own kind. We should want to help our own gender. And yeah, I find it disgusting that they accuse him of this. This is something that homosexual activists like to do, isn't it? They like to find great people from our past and then cast these aspersions on them. It's rather similar to the blackface, when they try and tell us that we had black people in our past, and they'll try and change white people in Roman times and what have you, and try and claim that they were black. Well, they do the same with they do the same. Homosexuals do the same and try to claim people from our past as that. So he wasn't married. Do you want to comment on this, Max?
Well, I find it sort of interesting that the people that make these kind of claims are people who generally regard themselves as being progressive or permissive, and in many cases homosexuals themselves. But rather than making this claim in such a way that it would present Gordon in a good light, so that they don't turn around and say, "Oh, Gordon was a homosexual, and he's a shining example of somebody who's gay, who can do good works, and who can is very compassionate towards his people and very compassionate towards children that are destitute, etc." Blah 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 blah. Instead of saying that, they just imply that he was homosexual, and he was probably they tend to imply. And you've not sort of mentioned any evidence in this case, but I've seen it in other cases, tend to imply that his interest in young boys would have been because he was perhaps a covert paedophile or something like that. And so what they do is they assign their own predisposition to the famous person, but do it in such a way that it besmirches their reputation rather than enhances it. And that's one of the things which I think is particularly abhorrent in these kind of accusations.
Yeah, there's no evidence for it whatsoever. Just the fact that he cared for poor boys, basically. And, you know, I agree with the author that said that it says more about Strachey than it does about Gordon. It says more about these homosexual activists, that they are the sort of people that couldn't be trusted around small boys than him. And don't forget, this was in the Victorian times as well, and a lot of people didn't really know anything about sex at all. It was, I've mentioned that before in a book called Are We a Declining Race, which was written specifically about that and the fact that the British people really didn't know very much about sex at all, and that actually drove them on to creating the British Empire because they weren't involving themselves in sex all the time. Well, moving on to his travels, during a visit to Bulgaria, Gordon and his friend Gessie became involved in an incident when a Bulgarian couple told them that their 17-year-old daughter had been abducted into the harem of an Ottoman pasha and asked them to free their daughter. Popular legend has it that Gordon and Gessie broke into the pasha's palace at night to rescue the girl, but the truth is less dramatic. Gordon and Gessie demanded that Ahmed Pasha allow them to meet the girl alone, and their request was granted after much arm twisting. Upon meeting the girl, she confirmed that she had been abducted and wanted to go home. Gordon and Gessie then threatened to go to the British and Italian press if she was not released at once, a threat that proved sufficient to win the girl her freedom. And I find this interesting because this is still going on in Pakistan. I've read numerous newspaper reports of girls, Christian girls, that have been abducted by Muslims and forced to marry Muslims in Pakistan. And because it's a Muslim country, the judges say, well, this is part of Sharia law. And she is now the wife of this Muslim. And these poor Christian girls who don't want to be there, that they've essentially been taken as a sex slave. And what we see here is this was going on in white countries. This was going on in Bulgaria 150 years ago. Bulgaria was under Muslims. It was under the Ottomans. And this was the sort of thing they would do. They would just kidnap these women along with the boys they would take to turn into Janissaries. And now, of course, we have the grooming gangs today. So I think there's similarities with that. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
No, I think your interpretation is pretty sound.
I'll be interested to know, because we have some Bulgarian listeners, one in particular that uses the chat room, and I'd be interested to know if he had actually heard of this, Gordon's visit to Bulgaria, because maybe it's the sort of thing that becomes a part of the legends or the stories of Bulgaria, that there was this British guy that actually rescued this Bulgarian woman from one of the Muslims. Well, Gordon was promoted to colonel on the 16th of February, 1872, and when passing through Constantinople, he made the acquaintance of the Prime Minister of Egypt, Raghib Pasha. The Egyptian Prime Minister opened negotiations for Gordon to serve under the Ottoman Khedive Ismail Pasha, who was popularly called Ismail the Magnificent on the account of his lavish spending. And after meeting Gordon in 1874, the Khedive Ismail said, "What an extraordinary Englishman. He doesn't want any money." Rather interesting. And we learn from this that Britain is on good terms with the Ottoman Empire at this time, 1872. Do you know much about that, when Britain was on good terms with the Ottomans, Max, about this time, 1872?
I'm not particularly aware of any sort of in-depth detail, just really that it was a sort of situation of our enemy's enemy is our friend, and we were struggling to contain the burgeoning Russian Empire at the time, where the Russians were expanding down through the Caucasus and down through Central Asia towards Afghanistan, and that's during that period the British government must have seen the Ottomans as an ally against Russia.
Well, yeah, because he ends up working for them for quite a while. The French-educated Ismail Pasha greatly admired Europe as the model for excellence in everything, being an especially passionate Italophile and Francophile, saying at the beginning of his reign, "My country is no longer in Africa, it is now in Europe." And we see the same thing with Turkey, don't we? Turkey thinking that it is now in Europe, just because it's become a little bit more civilized. Ismail was a Muslim who loved Italian wine and French champagne, and many of his more conservative subjects in Egypt and the Sudan felt alienated by a regime that was determined to westernize the country with little regard for tradition. And the languages of Khedive's court were Turkish and French, and not Arabic. And again, drinking alcohol, that's legal in Turkey as well, and not in the other Islamic countries. So I should imagine Egypt was fairly much, trying to be like Turkey at this time. Do you know much about Egypt at this time, Max, or Turkey?
Well, there were, during the 1800s and the early part of and the 20th century, basically, there were two threads running through the Arab world, one of which was Arab nationalism, which tended to be secular and which tended to want to copy the best of what it saw within the European nations. And the second thread was the Islamic movement, and where they were trying to establish a caliphate that would be an Islamic caliphate. And so on the one hand, you've got the kind of radical Arab Islamists who want to create a caliphate. And then on the other hand, you've got the Arab nationalists. And these extended even into the late 20th century, where you had people like Saddam Hussein, who was an Arab nationalist, who wasn't and who tried to create a secular Iraq. You have Bashar al-Assad in Syria, who has tried to create a secular society there, albeit that they do tolerate the religions that exist. And I think the same thing existed in Egypt as well.
Well, we'll see later on that we see this other force, the Islamic State. There was an equivalent of today's Islamic State that was actually taking place there at the same time. So, yeah, as you're saying there, Max, with these two different forces of Islam, the progressive Islam that was on the side of the nationalists, and then the fundamentalist Islam that was wanting to set up a caliphate and have the strictest Sharia law possible, exactly the same as ISIS today. Well, the Khedive's great dream was to make Egypt culturally a part of Europe, and he spent huge sums of money attempting to modernize and westernize Egypt, in the process going very deeply into debt. At the beginning of his reign in 1863, Egypt's debt had been 3 million in Egyptian pounds, but when Ismail's reign ended in 1879, Egypt's debt had risen to 93 million pounds. I mean, that's a huge amount that it's increased by there, about 30 times. The Khedive asked for Gordon to be made governor of Equatoria province, that comprised much of what is today South Sudan and northern Uganda. Ismail Pasha told Gordon that he wished to expand Equatoria into the rest of Uganda with the ultimate aim of absorbing the entire Great Lakes region of East Africa into the empire that Ismail wanted to build in Africa. The former Governor Baker's annual salary as Governor of Equatoria had been 10,000 Egyptian pounds, almost $1 million in today's money. And Ismail was astonished when Gordon refused that salary, saying that £2,000 per year was more than enough for him. So he only wanted to take 20% of what the governor had had before. And again, this shows you how much in demand British officers were and men from the British Empire were in these other countries, because this is a country that's run by the Ottomans and they want this British guy there as the governor, because they know he's not going to be corrupt, unlike the Turks and the Egyptians. Do you want to comment on any of this, Max?
No, I think that's a very sort of clear point that comes out of it. Yes, and it's also illustrative of the sort of ambitions that the Egyptians had at the time. Really, that they wanted to expand the empire down into Africa, and that they wanted to be seen as European rather than African.
It describes a lot of the way that the countries in the British Empire felt. You know, they felt very privileged and they wanted to be like Europe. They didn't see it as, oh, we're being oppressed by these horrible British people. The majority of them were very welcoming and very pleased that they were having all the gifts of civilization being brought to them. And they had access to trade and all the things that were being built and created all around the British Empire. It was seen as a positive thing. You wanted to have the British Empire there. They would treat you better than your own people would treat you, as we learned in China. Well, after a short stay in Cairo, Gordon proceeded to Khartoum in Sudan via Suakin and Berber. In Khartoum, Gordon attended a dinner with the Governor General Ismail Ayub Pasha, being entertained by barely dressed belly dancers, whom one of Gordon's officers drunkenly attempted to have sex with, leading to a disgusted Gordon walking out, saying that he was shocked that Ayub allowed these things to happen in his palace. So again, we see the virtuous Gordon here. He's not happy with this Muslim behaving like this, and he's not happy with his officer either for doing that. I'm surprised they didn't attack the officer, to be honest, for doing something like that. Wouldn't you think?
Well, I suppose he would have attacked the officer had the officer been actually raping the woman, but according to the account you've given here, the woman might actually have been a willing participant, in which case it's just debauchery as opposed to criminal.
Yeah, I guess it could have led to quite a diplomatic scene. That's quite serious. During his time in Sudan, Gordon was much involved in attempting to suppress the slave trade while struggling against a corrupt and inefficient Egyptian bureaucracy that had no interest in suppressing it. Gordon soon learned that his superior, the Governor General of the Sudan, Ismail Ayub Pasha, was deeply involved in the slave trade and doing everything within his power to sabotage Gordon's anti-slavery work by denying him supplies and leaking information to the slavers. Again, this shows us that what we were up against in the British Empire, trying to stop slavery, all the blacks in Africa, they did not want to see slavery stopped. They were the ones that wanted slavery to continue, and the Arabs. It was the white British that didn't want it to continue, and the black Africans and the Arabs were doing all they could to sabotage our efforts to stop slavery, basically. You know, it's the opposite of what we're taught today. Gordon, despite his position as an official in the Ottoman Empire, found the Ottoman-Egyptian system of rule inherently oppressive and cruel, coming into increasing conflict with the very system he was supposed to uphold. Later, stating about his time in the Sudan, "I taught the natives they had a right to exist. In the Ottoman Empire, power was exercised via a system of institutionalized corruption where officials looted their provinces via heavy taxes and by demanding kickbacks known as bakshish. Some of the money went to Constantinople, with the rest pocketed by the officials." Again, this is the system that the British Empire was putting a stop to. All of this institutionalized corruption that was going on. And he's telling the natives they have a right to exist. This man is caring about the natives. He's not oppressing them. This whole narrative of the British Empire oppressing the natives is bunkum. Gordon established a close rapport with the African peoples of Equatoria, such as the Nuer and the Dinka, who had long suffered from the activity of Arab slave traders and who naturally supported Gordon's efforts to stamp out the trade. The peoples of Equatoria had traditionally worshipped spirits present in nature, but were steadily being converted to Christianity by missionaries from Europe and the United States, which further encouraged Gordon in his efforts as governor of Equatoria, who, notwithstanding his position working for the Egyptian government, saw himself as doing God's work there. I'm not sure if the Dinka tribe still exist, but again, it shows you that was the economy in Africa was slavery, basically, and it was very hard to stop.
Yeah, and I think that what it shows is that although the Ottoman system of government is could be sort of equated with a kind of a feudal system, where in which the local pasha extorts money from the tribes and the common people under his control, and then passes on some of that money further up the chain to the sort of a national level, and to an imperial level. The feudal system existed there rather than being paternalistic in the way in which the feudal system was applied in Europe. It tended to be tyrannical in the sense that it was purely used to milk money out of people, irrespective of whether the milking of the money in that way was doing them harm or not.
Oh, it's totally tyrannical. They certainly didn't really look on these people as even being other humans, really. They just looked at them as resources that they could use and abuse. And you've got Gordon here who's saying, well, you know, you have a right to exist. You have a right to go about your lives. You know, you shouldn't be enslaved by these other peoples just because you're not as big as they are. I think the Dinka were one of these small in stature tribes. Well, Gordon was not impressed with the forces of the Egyptian state. The soldiers of the Egyptian army were fellahin, peasant conscripts who were both ill-paid and ill-trained. The other force for law and order were the much-feared Bashi Bazouks, irregulars who were not paid a salary but were expected to support themselves by looting. The Bashi Bazouks were extremely susceptible to corruption and were notorious for their brutality, especially to non-Muslims. So again, we see the treatment of non-Muslims. They're considered to be different to Muslims. And we see that this is just like China. And these people are expected to just loot and pillage rather than actually being paid a salary. Well, Gordon himself often personally intercepted the slave convoys to arrest the slavers and break the chains of the slaves. But he found that the corrupt Egyptian bureaucrats usually then sold the freed Africans back into slavery. And the expense of caring for thousands of freed slaves who were a long way from home was burdensome. He eventually came into conflict with the Egyptian governor of Khartoum and Sudan over his efforts to ban the trade. This clash led to Gordon informing the Khedive that he did not wish to return to the Sudan, and he left for London. And during his time in London, he was approached by Sir William MacKinnon, an enterprising Scottish shipowner who had gone into partnership with King Leopold II of the Belgians with the aim of creating a chartered company that would conquer Central Africa, and they wished to employ Gordon as their agent in Africa. He accepted their offer, believing rather naively in Leopold's and MacKinnon's assurances that their plans were purely philanthropic and they had no interest in exploiting Africans for profit. But the Khedive, Ismail Pasha, wrote to him saying that he had promised to return and that he expected him to keep his word. Gordon agreed to return to Cairo and was asked to take the position of Governor General of the entire Sudan, which he accepted, and he now receives the honorific rank and title of Pasha in the Ottoman aristocracy. So he's gone from being a general in the British Army, he's now, and then he was Chinese Gordon in China, and now he's a pasha in the Ottoman aristocracy. He's high up in the Ottomans, and he's fighting against the slave trade and really having problems with doing that. I mean, imagine that. You're freeing these slaves, and then your superiors, when you send them to your superiors to send them on the train back to where they came from in Africa, your superiors are then selling them back into slavery.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it?
This is what we were up against. I mean, it's incredible. It's just the opposite of everything that we're told about the British Empire, don't you think?
Yeah, yeah. The traditional narrative nowadays is a travesty of the truth.
We should probably leave that here, and we'll get into some more of Gordon in Sudan next week, I think. So thank you very much for coming on today, Max.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.